It's been about 10 days since Chick-fil-A founder Truett Cathy died at age 93. There's no question that his legacy is alive and well. His career was the stuff of folklore, taking what some would call a humble chicken sandwich and building it into a $5 billion empire. To talk about his story, I brought together two Atlanta leaders who knew him well. Ken Bernhard has served as marketing consultant for Chick-fil-A for more than three decades. He's also Regents Professor of Marketing Emeritus at Georgia State University. Sam Williams is the former president of the Metro Atlanta Chamber of Commerce and, like Bernhard, watched the Cathy Empire grow over many years. You'll hear first from Ken Bernhard.
He's probably the most amazing man I've ever met. I have had the opportunity and blessing to work with the company continuously for 34 years. So when I joined the company as a marketing consultant, they had 35 employees. So it was a dinky little fast food company. It had been around for more than 10 years, but they were shooting for $77 million in sales that year versus the $5.5 billion they have now. And they have thousands of corporate employees as opposed to 35.
Why was he a remarkable man?
He was a remarkable man because he was the ultimate entrepreneur. He would try anything. And he started the company because of his sister, who had a little card shop in Greenbrier Mall, said there's no place to eat. And when a tuxedo rental company went out of business in Greenbrier Mall, she convinced Truett to set up a small little, I think it was 150 square feet or something like that, put a Henny Penny in there and start cooking some chicken and French fries and Cokes, and that was it. And, of course, it was very successful. And another mall in Savannah heard about it, and so he sold them a franchise. And after selling a few franchises, he was very unhappy with the other people's commitment to quality that he had. So he bought all of them back and started over.
Was it Chick-fil-A at that point?
He started Chick-fil-A in 1967, okay. Which was the Greenbrier Mall first.
Okay,
first
so that one. Was called Chick-fil-A.
It was called okay. Chick-fil-A. The product he invented in 1964 was the Chick-fil-A sandwich, which took him 4 years to develop. And it really came about because a supplier to the airlines, the pieces of chicken breast that they sold to the airlines, some of them were too big that the airlines didn't want to pay for them. So they convinced Truett to buy these bigger pieces of chicken breast. And he started, the real problem was if you cooked somebody ordered a hamburger and someone ordered chicken, it took too long for one versus the other. It wouldn't come out together. And you don't want to serve somebody their hamburger and the other person 5 minutes later get their chicken. So he started experimenting and ended up with the pressure cooked chicken that took 4 minutes. When it was deboned and de-skinned, took 4 minutes to do, which was the same as it took to make a hamburger. And, of course, he then played for 3 years with the seasoning and to get it right and got the sandwich. Well, then in 67, when his sister convinced him to start, that was really the first of really food in a mall, which was quite innovative. And he grew pretty rapidly the first several years, even though a lot of malls wouldn't take him because he closed on Sunday. And I guess then the super growth came when he went on the street in 1986 at the Briarcliff and La Vista right there. North Druid Hills and Briarcliff. North Druid Hills and Briarcliff, 1986, the first on the street
freestanding store.
First freestanding store.
Sam, what do you remember about Truett Cathy and how he developed his business?
Well, what I remember most about Truett was just his persona and his attitude. I never heard Truett say anything bad about anybody. He was always positive, always upbeat. Now, occasionally you meet people like that, and they're not consistent. You see them in one atmosphere, and they're different in another. Truett was the same wherever I ran into him. And I think the other thing that I was very impressed is that he cared so deeply about his employees and about young people. The scholarship programs that he developed were legendary, and how many young people have now got professional careers in all kinds of areas, not just in the food business, because of what he did. And then when he started getting into the whole idea of foster homes and taking care of children, that was his passion was taking care of young people who didn't have the breaks that he saw he had. And what he really wanted to do is he wanted to give them those kind of opportunities.
He taught 13-year-old Sunday school for 50 years. Yeah, I mean, 13-year-olds got to be the scariest group to teach imaginable.
Oh, yeah.
And did it for 50 years.
Yeah, and the things that he's built in the community. Truett gave away so much money and helped so many people through his philanthropy. And I think some of that's sort of the culture of the business community that Truett embodied, is that it's not enough to make money and be a high-profile personality. You got to give back. And boy, did he ever give back. I mean, he, you know, Warren Buffett keeps talking about he wants to give away his fortune in his lifetime. And I can't think of anybody in Atlanta who's done better at giving back than Truett did.
He wrote a book called Wealth, : Is It Worth It? And I love the book. And the answer, is it worth it, is only if you earn it fairly and give it away properly.
The Dwarf House, which was real. I thought the Dwarf House was actually the first freestanding
actually
store.
The first
that down
one
in
was,
Jonesboro, in South Metro.
He and his brother Ben actually in 1946 built the first unit, which was called the Dwarf Grill. And why was it called the Dwarf Grill? Because it only had 10 seats, and it was tiny. So they called it the Dwarf Grill. And after several years and expanded the place, they then changed the name to Dwarf House because it was bigger.
How many thousands and thousands of families have taken their children down there to walk through the little door, which was a conceit of his? This was a playful concept of his, I think, the tiny little door that you would enter in, right?
Yeah, and you hit the word for Truett Cathy, which is he was always playful. I mean, he drove a motorcycle until he was 90-something, always would play tricks on people and always having a laugh and playing little jokes and things and just an incredible disposition and personality. Another favorite saying of Truett's that I love and just along the lines we're talking about here is he said, if you aren't having fun, you're doing something wrong.
Sam Williams is the former president of the Metro Atlanta Chamber of Commerce. Ken Bernhardt is Regents Professor of Marketing Emeritus of Georgia State University and a longtime marketing consultant for Chick-fil-A. I'm Bill Nigut. You're listening to Two-Way Street. This next story comes from the file marked, "Just when you thought you'd heard it all, it turns out you haven't." Earlier this month, the Wall Street Journal published a story about a growing problem among British gardeners, the practice of snail chucking. Turns out British gardens have been overrun with plant-destroying snails this year. The Royal Horticultural Society did a study that revealed 1 out of 5 Brits admit they've disposed of snails by simply chucking them into their neighbors' yards. As you can imagine, this has led to mollusk mayhem in neighborhoods across the British Isles. Of course, anytime we need to have the curious customs of the British explained, I turn to my resident Atlanta expert in all things British, Kevin Glass. He's the headmaster of the Atlanta International School, but has vast knowledge beyond education, as you'll hear in our conversation.
Well, it's pretty outrageous and embarrassing, really. The survey you're referring to was over 1,500 people in England, Scotland, and Wales were surveyed about this. And what's interesting is that, you know, Londoners seem to be by far the worst at this outrageous habit. 30% of Londoners surveyed were chucking those snails into their neighbors' gardens. And yes, I can understand the position of folks in Scotland, where only 14% of Scottish gardeners were throwing snails. It's a significant difference. But I think it's a sort of a national question, and it's a character-forming question. It's also one that's based on no scientific rationality, because the common garden snail has a wonderful homing instinct, and you've got to chuck them at least 20 yards or 25 meters into your neighbor's garden. Otherwise, they will eventually, at their slow rate of progress, find their way back. And there's a great experiment that you all can do with this at home. Take some nail polish and paint, find some garden snails in your garden and paint their shells. And then please go ahead and throw them into your neighbor's garden. And you give it a day or two, at the most 5, and lo and behold, you will see that these snails will come back. So you've got to have a decent throwing arm to get them that far.
With that in mind, I, in reading the Wall Street Journal article, I was fascinated by the comments of a man named David Harcham, 74-year-old from central London. What did he say there?
I have employed the fast bowler of our local cricket team to instruct my wife in the art of the full toss. My neighbors, though, are using the same ploy. So it's more like tennis than cricket. And so you can just picture it, this 74-year-old and his wife playing snail tennis across their garden fence.
A woman who was quoted in the article, Jill Vickers, who is also a British gardener, she described her habit of chucking snails as, and again, it's so much better when you say it than I.
Well, Jill was talking about it being very naughty. Well, very naughty indeed. And of course it is. It speaks to a person's character. One of my good friends in London, her father is the president of the Kew Horticultural Society, right next to Kew Gardens there in London on the banks of the Thames. And in his youth, he used to put salt on snails and slugs, but he's since felt extreme remorse at this one, he was telling me, because, of course, they dissolve into a puddle of slime if you put salt on them, which is not very nice. And so now what he does is he basically gathers them in a bucket and will take them down to the local village tip where they can happily compost whatever is thrown down there.
One of the people quoted in the Wall Street Journal article says the reason this sort of thing happens is that the Londoners hate their neighbors, and they're glad to throw things in each other's yards. Would you go that far?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily go that far to say that, Bill. However, it's very un-English to address your feelings directly with the person in front of you. You'll talk about everything else: the weather, the shocking state of transport, the economy, health, you name it. You will never address the issue face to face. So perhaps it is a way of venting your frustration on the neighbor by throwing snails into their garden. In the dead of night. In fact, my friend David Collison, he talks about a few years ago, he was actually out there in the middle of the night, because snails, as we all know, are nocturnal. So they come out and go hunting for your basil and for your cabbages in the middle of the night. So he was out there in the dead of night with a torch, trying to find all of these snails who were busy about his garden in Kew. And two neighbors actually saw his torch in the garden at night and called the police, and the police then showed up to arrest him, as they thought he was a burglar about to break into the house. Of course, at the time, he was wearing nothing but a dressing gown and a pair of wellies, and so he hasn't done that since.
I do think Miss Vickers, who acknowledges that her habit of chucking snails is very naughty, she does have some cause. She tells the Wall Street Journal reporter she's very distressed because they've eaten her aubergine. Her dahlias, too, have been ravaged.
Her hydrangeas.
So I think we can perhaps excuse her chucking behavior.
Oh, absolutely. Can you imagine if you spent months of your life out there tending your beautiful English garden? And, you know, snails breed at a prodigious rate. And so they can have six or seven batches of eggs a year. So the garden quickly becomes overrun. This past winter was very mild in the south of England, and so the frost that normally takes down the snail eggs was not there. And, of course, it was a pretty wet spring, so plants grew very thick and green and luscious, including Mrs. Vickers' bear's breeches and hydrangeas. And so you can imagine her distress when she wakes up one morning to find her plants ravaged by the pesky little snails.
But she does not have to chuck those snails. Let's make it clear. She may choose that. But perhaps, Kevin, she could be thinking about using beer to bait the snails. And if she were to do that, is there anything that tells us what beer she should use?
Interesting you ask this one, Bill. A lady called Pippa Greenwood, who often reports and works for Gardener's World, she recently did a piece on Gardener's Question Time on Radio 4, where she was talking about an experiment that she ran a couple of years ago, where she experimented on different types of beer to see which type of beer was the most efficacious against the garden snail and of course slugs. And lo and behold, the beer that is most effective by several orders of magnitude against the garden snail is actually Guinness. So it shows you that snails have got a rather good taste in beer.
The Irish must be very proud.
Well, I think the Irish must be very proud indeed. And clearly Ireland has far less of a snail problem than England. So perhaps they're using their native Guinness to take down the native garden snails of Ireland.
Before we finish, Kevin, I do think it's important to point out that although snails are considered by British gardeners to be pests, in fact, the snail is very, very useful in one industry.
Yes, indeed. And this is a little bit counterintuitive and, to use an American term, somewhat gross. But snail mucus, believe it or not, is considered to have some pretty powerful regenerative properties. And so it's gained in recent years increasing traction and increasing popularity in the cosmetic industry. And you'll now find snail mucus part of all of these various potions and unguents that you can apply to your face that are sort of holistic and organic to help in the aging process.
Being the academic that you are, I believe you came with a snail poem.
So this is a wonderful poem, and all of the listeners, I think, of course, will recognize the author A.A. Milne of Winnie the Pooh fame, and he wrote this wonderful poem called The Four Friends. Ernest was an elephant, a great big fellow. Leonard was a lion with a 6-foot tail. George was a goat, and his beard was yellow, and James was a very small snail. Leonard had a stall and a great big strong one. Ernest had a manger, and its walls were thick. George found a pen, but I think it was the wrong one, and James sat down on a brick. Ernest started trumpeting and cracked his manger. Leonard started roaring and shivered his stall. James gave a huffle of a snail in danger, and nobody heard him at all. Ernest started trumpeting and raised such a rumpus. Leonard started roaring and trying to kick. James went on a journey with the goat's new compass, and he reached the end of his brick. Ernest was an elephant and very well intentioned. Leonard was a lion with a brave new tail. George was a goat, as I think I have mentioned, but James was only a snail.
Kevin Glass is the headmaster of the Atlanta International School and our resident expert on all things British. That's all from us this week. I hope you'll join me again for Two-Way Street next Saturday at 4. In the meantime, I'm Bill Nigut. Have a great week.
I'm one of the oldest species that the world has ever seen. I hardly seem to move, but you can see where I have been. 'Cause everywhere I go I leave a silver slimy trail. You guessed it, I'm a snail.